peace and social justice on. I want to thank you all for helping out and making your contributions. I'll see you again next week. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program for Friday, October 29th, 2021, the Fall Pledge Drive edition. I'm your host today, Robert Jones. On the program, two issues we'll look at. First up, we'll speak to the founder and president of Heroic Hearts Project, a proprietary program offered to veterans suffering PTSD who are interested in pursuing psychedelic treatment options. Following that, on today's program, we'll be joined by the founder of Chico Friends on the Street to reflect on the life and activism of the late homeless activist Jana Burgess Henry, passed away just recently. Stick around for all that. We'll be right back in just a minute. KZFR is currently in the middle of our fall pledge drive. If you're listening to the Peace and Social Justice Program, then you, like me, value community radio and the kinds of important local public affairs programming produced here at KZFR. Please donate at kzfr.org/donate. Not only will your donation help keep programs like Peace and Social Justice on the air, but your financial support makes it possible for those in our community who may not be in a position to donate to continue to hear important local public affairs programming. In the critical years ahead, as the fate of American democracy remains under threat, programs like Peace and Social Justice provide you with reality-based facts against what has become, for many in our community, a post-truth America. Please pledge at kzfr.org/donate or call or text 601-340-KZFR, or you can use Venmo at KZFR901. This is Robert Jones, host and volunteer programmer, saying thank you. Welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program. I'm your host, Robert Jones. According to the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, approximately one out of five veterans suffers from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's probably a low estimate. A recent study found that since the 9/11 military operations, the amount of active duty military who've been killed in combat is 7,057. However, the number of active duty personnel and veterans who have committed suicide is a whopping 30,000, almost 31,000. I did a little math, and that would come out to about four veterans per day commit suicide. A guest on today's show has devoted his life to helping those kinds of veterans. Jesse Gould is a pioneer in psychedelic therapies. As founder and president of the Heroic Hearts Project, he has spearheaded the research and acceptance of ayahuasca therapy programs for military veterans. Jesse has raised over $500,000 in scholarships from donors, including Dr. Bronner's, partnered with the world's leading ayahuasca treatment centers, and is researching psychiatric applications with the University of Colorado Boulder, the University of Georgia, and Imperial College of London. His mission is to help military veterans struggling with mental trauma and spread awareness of the benefits that ayahuasca therapies offer as an alternative treatment to pharmaceuticals. Jesse has spoken globally about the benefits of psychedelics on mental health and has been featured in the New York Times and Rolling Stone magazine, and is recognized as one of the most influential voices in psychedelics today. Jesse Gould, it is my honor to welcome you to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Robert, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So Jesse, this is just a fascinating mission that you've dedicated your life to. Just for the listeners, for some background, how in the world did you come to this place where you are a veteran yourself? How did you get to the place where you founded Heroic Hearts? And I believe it was in 2017. So it's been 4 years. Can you give us a little story of your background?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll start by saying, you know, you highlighted the veteran mental health crisis that's going on. And the statistics are probably much worse than what you presented. By a lot of estimates, VA's own estimates, anywhere from 17 to 22 veterans a day have committed suicide over the past few decades. And so if you start calculating that number, it's very, very high, and especially in comparison. My background that relates to this especially is I was an Army Ranger, which is a special operations unit. I was enlisted, a non-commissioned officer. I did three combat deployments to Afghanistan. I was in charge of 30-plus individuals in training operations back at home and overseas. And overall, I actually had a very good military career, learned a lot about myself, challenged myself, and got a lot out of it, especially in terms of leadership and you know, just having a better sense of who I am. But when I got out, went back into finance, that was my original path and background, and quickly started having some mental health issues, which manifested in anxiety, depression, alcoholism. And, you know, some red flags popped up where I just knew I wasn't living to my previous self, to that Ranger self, and I didn't know why. And I tried all sorts of different things, some holistic stuff, you know, or even just full body, you know, exercise, meditation, changing social environments, all that kind of stuff. And they helped, but to a limited extent, to the point where I went to the VA. I sought mental health treatment. At that time, I really wasn't interested in going on medication like SSRIs, but I figured I should at least talk to a therapist because I wasn't able to get over this wall that I kept running into. And I just knew that, you know, the path I was on would not lead to good outcomes. And when I went there, unfortunately, the VA was very unhelpful for me, where it was essentially put to me that unless I was willing to go on the full protocol, which involved medication, that there was a limit that they could do. They could give me a few sessions, but that's about it. And so I left there sort of feeling, you know, I was on my own, like either I'd ignore this until I couldn't ignore it, or I'd have to figure it out for myself. And, you know, on the top of this, I just want to say, you know, I'm not anti-medication. There's a time and place, and it's definitely saved lives, but I do have the opinion that it's been over-prescribed without the proper supervision and overly relied on. And if you look at the actual results, then it's not great, which is why we have such a severe mental health crisis, because if they worked as effectively as we kind of assume they do, then we wouldn't have as many suicides. But anyway, so that led me on this path, and I heard about this substance called ayahuasca. I had no background of psychedelics, no interest, didn't self-identify with psychedelics or illegal drug use. That wasn't sort of part of my makeup. But because I was struggling so much and heard some amazing tests, some stories coming from this obscure Amazonian mixture, some part of me, you know, got really intrigued. And more and more, as things in my life started deteriorating, I decided to give it a shot and took the leap of faith, went to Peru, and went through this week-long sort of ayahuasca traditional retreat.
That's the voice of Jesse Gould. He's the founder and president of the Heroic Hearts Project. Well, Jesse, with regard to the use of psychedelics as opposed to, or maybe in addition to, pharmaceuticals, when it comes to psychedelics, a lot of folks are probably familiar with things like mescaline or, you know, LSD or psilocybin. And in your experience, and if there's science on this, what does the ayahuasca provide? How does that, what kind of mechanism? How does it work?
Yeah, so ayahuasca, I mean, most of the psychedelics, the hallucinogenics, work similar if we're talking about their trauma and some of the common effects of them. They all have different feelings. They all have different potentials, pluses and minuses. But when used with intention and in certain settings, they can all be very therapeutic. They can all be very life-changing for the individual. And they can all, well, for most part, a lot of them can be recreational as well, where, you know, people use them to sort of escape or just have fun. So ayahuasca comes from two Amazonian plants, generally speaking, from the Peruvian tradition at least. There's a lot of traditions because this has grown through tribes throughout the Amazon, which encompasses a lot of area. But the Peruvian tradition, which has become more popular, has the two main plants are ayahuasca, which is a vine, and a leaf called chacruna, generally. And it's this combination that brings in the psychedelic process. It's brewed down to this very thick sort of tea. And when you drink it, that's what induces you to go into a 4 or 5 hour long psychedelic trip. The main chemical that has the psychedelic properties is called DMT. So it's similar to psilocybin. It's similar to, in some ways, LSD. They're all chemically different, obviously. But like I said, they just have different personalities. For ayahuasca, it tends to have less of a recreational side just because it can be a very intense. It tends to be one of the more potent of the psychedelics where, like I said, the trip can last long and generally very physical, very emotional. There's a purging side of it that happens to a lot of people where a lot of people puke, but they can also, you know, sweat a lot or move around a lot. But on the psychedelic front, the reason why we think it's beneficial or the reason why it shows to be beneficial is that for people with trauma or people who have issues in their life that they're trying to process, it puts you in this sort of altered state and it brings a lot of these things on the surface to where you almost have to confront them. But you're confronting them in this altered state, in this sort of weirdly metaphorical, dreamlike, intense state. So it's not as if you are going right back to the trauma picture for picture. So it can still be intense. It will bring up a lot of those emotions in the experience, but that's part of the processing, because what happens with trauma and the reason why it tends to manifest itself in behaviors and you know, physical damage to ourselves, because we compress it, we compartmentalizing it. So it's still affecting us. It's still affecting our subconscious. We're just not processing it. We're not letting it go through our body or experiencing it in a way that is healthy, that is not crippling us down the line. And so through these psychedelic processes, it brings it up to the surface to where we have to confront it. We have to get it out. And oftentimes it also allows sort of a reframing to happen. Whereas before we might've seen ourselves as a victim, or it might've been on this repeat cycle. Through this process, it actually allows us to see it in a different light. Sometimes a third person, sometimes from the other person's perspective, sometimes from our perspective, just in a different sort of mentality. So all of these things on the psychological level, plus many more, are the reasons why we're seeing such profound effects with psychedelics for things like PTSD or other traumas. There's also a lot of and growing evidence around potential physical benefits of these psychedelics, where they might actually have restorative properties and beneficial properties towards the physical brain, which in combination to this psychological processing is a very potent potential therapeutic modality.
You mentioned various kinds of evidence with regard to the benefits of ayahuasca for psychological PTSD and for some evidence for physiological improvements. I'm wondering, there's obviously a lot of anecdotal evidence. Have there been psychological studies, maybe experts who study things like PTSD and depression? Have there been, quote, legitimate scientific studies that have shown evidence of benefit of ayahuasca?
Yeah, there's growing research on across the psychedelic spectrum, ayahuasca included. Ayahuasca tends to be a little bit harder to study just because it is this combination of two plants in a drink mixture, which if you know clinical trials through the FDA, they want to distill it to sort of the baseline chemical with controlled settings all around. So just the way, especially in the traditional setting with all the ceremonies and the songs, can be a very hard thing to sort of keep to its pure essence while also doing a clinical study. So there is that moving forward. But especially in Brazil, they've done a lot of studies where with prisoners, they've shown recidivism go down. So prisoners who get out and they go through an ayahuasca therapy process, they're much less likely to go back to prison. They did a double-blind study a couple years back for depression, and they showed a significant, statistically significant benefit of those that used ayahuasca for depression. But we can also extrapolate from other psychedelics, because like I said, they on a psychological basis tend to work in the same sort of way. And so MDMA, which is not necessarily a traditional psychedelic, but again, it can enhance therapy, is going through the FDA right now for treatment for treatment-resistant depression, PTSD, excuse me. And it's in third stage trial. So it's been declared a breakthrough therapy. It's been having amazing results, 67%, I think, the last trial versus, I think, in the low 33%, which was the alternatives, which was just talk therapy. So this is having a almost double benefit to any sort of traditional talk therapy for the hardest cases of PTSD of using MDMA. And then psilocybin, which is from mushrooms, psychedelic mushrooms. It's in earlier stages in stage two of the FDA, but it's been declared a breakthrough therapy for depression, and they're trying to use it for all sorts of different other mechanisms. And back in the 1950s, 1960s, they've shown all sorts of other benefits, potentially reducing alcoholism and other addictive behaviors. And just for more recently, end-of-life patients, those who were had terminal illnesses, it severely reduced their fear, anxiety, and depression going into death, essentially. And so we're seeing all sorts of wide spectrum benefits, which is great because there's been sort of this void in advancement in the mental health field, but it's also exposing that mental health is a much more complex issue. It's not just about treating this black or white depression. There's a lot more there that factors into it. And the reason why we're only now getting a lot of these studies is because of the illegality in the U.S. and the scheduling of it. So psychedelics as well as cannabis are in the Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive, and the government has actively prevented research into these substances based off of, you know, fear and propaganda and the war on drugs, perpetuating that. And so there's essentially been this sort of 40-50 year hold on any sort of research. And so finally it's starting to reemerge just because the results are almost undeniable.
Peace and social justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by Chico Performances, presenting David Sedaris on Tuesday, November 2nd at Laxon Auditorium. David Sedaris, one of America's preeminent humor writers, is beloved for his personal essays, short stories, and as a master of satire. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898-6333, or at chicoperformances.com. I'm speaking with Jesse Gould, the founder and president of Heroic Hearts, the Heroic Hearts Project. Jesse, so, you know, you did mention the drug laws in the United States, and of course there's stigma attached to drug use and you know, some questions of, you know, the drug trade. I mean, I've read online people who are opposed to these kinds of therapies, and inevitably they'll talk about the drug war and the war on drugs, the kinds of things you raise. I'm wondering if you could describe a specific process of how this works. Say, starting from a veteran who's having PTSD and has not found success with other therapies, who contacts the Heroic Hearts Project, take us from that veteran to the actual experience of the psychedelic.
Yeah, absolutely. And to each their own on the recreational side. I mean, that's not me to comment on. And there are people that, you know, inadvertently, I mean, most people that do it recreationally are doing it for escape, like to enjoy it or what have you. Sometimes they do inadvertently find that benefit from it. There's a lot of cases of people going to Joshua Tree and doing mushrooms and finding profound benefit from that. I would say, especially people with very poignant trauma like PTSD, that's not necessarily the most advisable. If you can do it in sort of a more structured setting, intention-based setting, with a guide, with a program, then it's just going to be, from what I've seen, more effective, more secure, more safe. It's going to set you up for success. And at the very least, anybody who's never done any sort of psychedelics, at least, very least, have a sitter, have somebody that knows what they're doing. Because I guess the risk on the other side is that, you know, if you don't have this structure, if you don't have these guides, and you have a really intense ceremony or a really intense experience, then it can be really open you up and just be very unstabling. And then it can be hard for people to bring you back. But if you have the preparation, the secure spot, the safety, all that kind of stuff, can really be poignant in terms of helping you pass through your trauma. So, for instance, for our program, this is what I've designed and learned over the past few years, and working with professionals and, you know, experts in the field to get their advice on it, and just from our own experience of working with veterans, my experience of what was severely lacking. And the psychedelic itself is great, but it's not a magic pill. It really enhances our ability to get through trauma, and it enhances traditional talk therapy. But you need, there's much more to it. It's not this magic thing. You go there, boom, you're cured. And so a veteran comes to us, we do basic safety checks. Each psychedelic's a little bit different, and we work across the spectrum depending on where the person's at. But, you know, certain medications, certain health issues can be sort of problematic. So you want to make sure you know about those if the person's intending on using it. If they pass all that, and for us, when we have the financial means to organize retreats, then we'll start getting groups together. And the preparation generally starts about a month or two out. So we'll just get person that mind frame of like, okay, this is the logistics. You got to go over the top level stuff of, you know, if they're going to Peru, Costa Rica, what have you. Make sure the flights are good. Make sure the passport's good. All that basic traveling kind of stuff. But then beyond that, that's when the intention really starts of getting their mind in terms of that, where they know they're doing this. They are focused on that. They can start organizing their world to where it will help get them to the spot where they need to be before that. So that involves diets in terms of eating certain foods, and in terms of, you know, getting certain things like caffeine and cannabis out of your system. You know, reducing social media, reducing all these externalities that like amp us up that don't necessarily do anything good for our mental health. The point is leading up to it to get ready for these retreats. When they go there, the retreat centers we use, we vetted, so they're safe. They know what they're doing. These are all experts that have great track records. We try to do it as much as possible, especially ayahuasca in the traditional setting. There's just a lot of power and beauty to that, and really puts people in this different container than they're used to, which signals to them that there is going to be change. And so then that's where the substance itself, whether it's psilocybin, ayahuasca, that's where that does the work. By the time they get there, they're prepared, and so they generally hit the ground running as opposed to kind of being open-ended. And then after that and during that is when the integration and processing starts. So oftentimes people get these downloads, they get these profound messages, they get all sorts of stuff and reflections on their life. And reflections are only as good as what we do as a result of them, how we react to them. If you see negative patterns in your life, or you see some bad habits that you're doing, if you don't put active steps to change them, then you're just going to fall right back into those. So that's the after process. That's the, what we call integration. When they get back home, oftentimes we build our worlds, which support our trauma, which support us going back into these ruts. And so how do we, with this new opportunity that we see them, that we were able to get outside of our bubble, how do we enact changes in our life that promote a healthier existence, that promote us maintaining what this great feeling that often people have immediately after these retreats? So that's always the hard part, because everybody's different and everybody needs different boundaries, different check-ins. But that's sort of the talk and getting them prepared for that. And so when they do, and they enact like a habit, like exercising every day or meditation or yoga every day, then those people are the ones that really, you know, take the advantages that they get through this process and do amazingly well. And we've seen some real transformations from you know, people who are clearly struggling and probably were, you know, at the rope's end to the complete reaffirmation of their life.
KZFR is currently in the middle of our fall pledge drive. If you're listening to the Peace and Social Justice program, then you, like me, value community radio and the kinds of important local public affairs programming produced here at KZFR. Please donate at kzfr.org/donate. Not only will your donation help keep programs like Peace and Social Justice on the air, but your financial support makes it possible for those in our community who may not be in a position to donate to continue to hear important local public affairs programming. In the critical years ahead, as the fate of American democracy remains under threat, programs like Peace and Social Justice provide you with reality-based facts against what has become, for many in our community, a post-truth America. Please pledge at kzfr.org/donate or call or text 601-340-KZFR, or you can use Venmo at KZFR901. This is Robert Jones, host and volunteer programmer, saying thank you.
Hello, I'm Shauna O'Shaughnessy, president and CEO of Community Housing Improvement Program, better known as CHIP. We are a Chico-based nonprofit providing affordable housing and related services to the North Valley. We manage 18 rental properties with more than 1,800 residents. We help families achieve home ownership by helping them build their own affordable homes. This year, we celebrated the completion of our 2,000th home. We are excited about our newest Chico project, Creekside Place, a rental community that will provide 101 units for seniors 62 and older, which includes 15 units reserved for seniors experiencing homelessness or are at risk of homelessness. Creating communities is hard work, but it's an investment that gives back in many wonderful ways, which is exactly why we value KZFR. We believe community-powered radio plays a crucial role in providing a much-needed, community-based point of view on important news and information. And it creates a diverse programming that we might not otherwise get. We want to see our community flourish, and that's why we hope you support KZFR's fundraising drive this year.
Go to kzfr.org to support and donate. Keep your favorite community radio station live and local. KZFR's pledge drive. You can donate at kzfr.org.
We're speaking with Jesse Gould. He is the founder and president of HeroicHeartsProject.org. So, Jesse, I have a question. Some questions about the actual process. So, if a veteran passes through, you know, the check process and everything's fine, and they go to the actual experience. Is it like a multi-day experience? And are there folks around? I'm thinking too. Is it a kind of guided psychedelic trip, or is it a group? Do people do whatever they want to do? Like, is it organized, or is it like? I'm just trying to picture the actual event and what kinds of experiences or what kind of experiences a veteran would expect. And also, if somebody, I mean, look, I don't know the details, but if somebody has a quote bad trip or someone's freaking out, there are people there to assist. So how does that work as far as like the kind of the mechanics of the actual process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the point of us vetting these centers, and that's the point of us developing this program, to make everything as streamlined as possible. So there are no surprises. People are supported. They feel secure. And even if they have a challenging experience, there's people there to support that and help them understand why it's challenging. So I'll hit that point first, just because the common language we hear is this bad trip, and that's what people fear. And that's sort of the arguments against psychedelics, is that, oh, it's going to cause psychosis, it's going to cause people going to the hospital because of bad trips, all this kind of stuff. You know, the psychosis side, it's sort of a debatable. If somebody's perfectly healthy, especially on the mental framework, it's not going to cause that. The only unknowns are if people have the predisposition that they are already going to get psychosis genetically or some sort of schizophrenia. There is some debate as to whether this or cannabis accelerates that, but there's really no evidence on that. And it's, again, people who already were predispositioned to having that. But somebody who's perfectly healthy and stable, that really is not a fear or concern with these substances. The thought of a bad trip is really, in our experience, just lack of preparation and lack of set and setting. You know, it's either a person takes the substance, they have no idea what they're doing, they do too big of a dose, their setting's uncontrollable, you know, the not great music or not great personalities. And so then they can get really into this sort of like freak out kind of thing. But on the counter, if you have spots where it's safe and secure, they might have this very challenging experience, but they can get past it. The challenge is part of it in a lot of ways, because these traumas have been suppressed for so long. It's obviously going to be hard. It's going to be emotional for people to go into it. And the point is to dive into that, to steer into that, because that's how you process it. That's how you face it. So having that supportive network where people can face that, as opposed to this, what we say, freak out, is part of it. So that, again, is just all in the vetting and the program around it. With the veterans, we've seen very challenging experience, but I would never say I've seen a bad trip or the freak out of what we kind of have come to learn about in popular media or from, you know, certain friends or what have you. The experience itself, I'll focus on ayahuasca because that's a big part of what we do, but it can vary. You know, everything's a little bit different, whether it's ketamine clinic, whether psilocybin, you know, each substance is slightly different. So you're going to handle them differently in terms of retreats and protocols. And there's all sorts of different mix and matches depending that are starting to emerge and have basis behind them. But if we're just doing a pure ayahuasca retreat, generally, like I said, we use sort of traditional styles. The shaman, the healers, the maestros come from these cultures, come from these tribes where they learned this from very early age, and they're maestros, masters. So they've gone through their apprenticeship and know how to use this. And, you know, from our side, we're not here to take that. We're here to work with these communities, work with these healers. And they're happy to work with us in this exchange. And that's, you know, in our mind, the beautiful way of going about it. So generally, the retreat, you know, like they'll go there. It's an all-inclusive thing. They have comfort living spots. They're there. There's generally going to be no electronics, no outside. They're there to heal. And they'll be over the course of a week, generally speaking. Again, all these variables are changeable, but this is sort of the general dynamic. A week. Over the course of that week, there'll be multiple ceremonies, and each ceremony will happen a specific day. They go in there. Generally, they'll be under the influence of the ayahuasca. So they'll be in this ceremonial hut, which is called Maloka. Around it, the shaman will be at one side. And when they take it, they'll be in their spot. They might, you know, speak a little bit, but it's a very internal thing. And if somebody's having a very challenging trip, then either the facilitators of the retreat will be there or the shaman will be there to help them through. But otherwise, it tends to be a very sort of inward sort of process that you're going through it. And then the next day or the next morning, everybody will share, kind of have like group therapy sort of sessions where people can talk about it, help each other process. And that's how the course of the week goes. So it's structured, but it's also like it's not programmatic. It's a little bit more open than maybe going to a therapist where it's a very dogmatic kind of thing. But again, it's working with everything. So it's trying to bring sort of this traditional style with what Westerners know to make it more effective. And on the point of multiple ceremonies, for sort of a crude description, if you view trauma as kind of working in layers where it's generally speaking, even with PTSD, there might be the one moment that really propagates it, but oftentimes it is trauma over the course of a person's life, and especially early childhood trauma makes people much more susceptible to later trauma. And so the multiple ceremonies really allow people to either unpackage different things or get really deep down into the baseline trauma and all the stuff that goes on top. And so over the course of that, they really get this sort of full kind of reset, but also a deep dive into it as opposed to kind of more of a surface level. And so that's why we really have seen great results with multiple ceremonies over the course of about a week.
Yeah, I want to ask you about those results. And I'm thinking, as you were describing the process, you know, I'm thinking that, first of all, you have, well, most people have, you know, some trauma, and not to the degree that, say, a military veteran who witnessed horrific acts would have. And if you are taking the ayahuasca and these emotions, these images, these things are coming up, I would imagine that, you know, it sounds to me like what I'm thinking is, if it were me, I would really require trust, because I would feel vulnerable. It seems like, who knows what's going to come up? Who knows what trauma, what pain, what tears, what thoughts? And being in a setting where you could be vulnerable and you won't be judged if you, whatever happens. And of course, you know, if you, I mean, I'm generalizing here, but I would imagine that, you know, the military folks who take part in this, you know, the military is, it's, you know, you have to be tough, right? So there's these values. I'm wondering, is there a process by which the veterans, the participants, are made to feel vulnerable? They could express whatever comes up in a trusting, caring setting. And how does that work?
I mean, that, again, in terms of the program and the vetting of the spots, it's finding those safe spots that we trust. So then that way, you know, that was kind of my mission when I found the retreat I was doing. I had to do a lot of research, and I still didn't know, just because there wasn't parameters. There wasn't, like, there are now, but there really wasn't like a trip advisor for this or this spot. And then, like, how do you trust these reviews? And so that's why we really focus on the vetting and trying out these protocols ourselves. That way the veterans come to us and they know they can trust us, because it's for veterans, by veterans, our coaches are all veterans. And so then that way there's that bridge where there's veterans taking them there, and that allows them. And so the facilitators that we bring to these retreats have been through the same sort of experience, and they'll be in there. They won't be drinking the ayahuasca, so they'll be there to watch over and help out. So that's the really assuring thing. The other side of it is having groups of other veterans. They know they're in the trenches together. So it kind of brings them back. But generally speaking, a lot of times it's the ayah or the psychedelic itself does a lot of the heavy lifting there, where a lot of people will come in and they'll be sort of tight-lipped, or kind of that stereotypical veteran of just, you know, the strong, silent kind of type. And then by the end, especially with some big breakthroughs through it, people become very open. They see that they can let go. They see that they're in a supportive circle. They see that other people are suffering, but also persevering as well. And so it's a beautiful evolution to see over the course of just a very small period of time. Where you see these big transformations, and people realize that, like, there's it's not strength in suppressing your traumas. It's not strength in not sharing. There's strength in actually letting this stuff go, because then you're a better human being and you're a stronger human being. And so that's sort of the learning process. But it does seem to be a pretty consistent result of the psychedelic, which is great. And I think that's part of the therapy, where they learn that they can express these emotions down the line, so then that way, you know, they're not further compartmentalizing future trauma. And so actively learning, not only processing their old trauma, but actively learning how to interact in the world in a real way. And with veterans, that's one of the big things you see, is they're almost stuck in this military mindset. The whole process of the military is to make you a soldier, indoctrinate you into being a soldier, a part of this bigger unit, to be more effective. And there's not really a return to civility, and not really a return indoctrination to get it out of the military. So people are stuck in these sort of very regimented mind frames and ways of viewing things and themselves, which is good in some sense. You know, their discipline is always good, but it can be very prohibiting. With their wife, with their lives, with their family. And so I do feel like the psychedelic process, these big experiences, can kind of sort of shake that up enough to where they're not stuck in those ruts. They're not stuck in those old ways. And then they can finally cross the border becoming, or starting to become, a civilian, and, you know, interacting with it in that way, in a healthy way.
Well, if you go to the website, heroicheartsproject.org, which I've done, there are some pretty amazing testimonial videos. You can tell that there's some life-changing, some positive life-changing events that have taken place with some of these participants. And on that topic, Jesse, I'm curious. So you started the foundation in 2017. How many participants, how many veterans have participated? And do you keep track of, quote, the successes, or what are your results so far after 4 years?
So, yeah, over the course of 4 years, we definitely started slow at the beginning, just starting the nonprofit, but we also wanted to make sure we were doing things right. You know, it's always been a quality over quantity sort of system, and we're dealing with a system of veterans that have fallen through the VA cracks. There's really no infrastructure, so we're one of the few organizations that's building infrastructure where there is none. And so there's a lot of, you know, risk there, or there's a lot of considerations there. So we've always trying to be as conscientious and learn from each experience that we have. And so to date, by the end of this year, I think we'll have served over 100, I think near 125. And then in the next year, in the coming years, we are well on our way to serve multiple hundreds over the course of a year, and just sort of expand. Again, this year especially, we've been really making sure our systems are in place to expand to that, because our wait list currently is over 800 veterans, and so we want to be there to serve them. And so I think we will be very well set in the next year to do that. In terms of results, you know, we've worked with a few universities. We've done some internal polling, all that. So the universities on the scientific level, we worked with the University of Georgia for an initial study, and it showed a significant reduction in neuroticism in a lot of the participants, statistically significant, which is actually pretty interesting for the sake of how neuroticism relates to some of these issues that they're having, PTSD, getting focused on certain things, not being able to go. And so that reduction, or that kind of going back to normal levels, is actually a very interesting result in terms of mental health therapy. From kind of a more or less scientific manner, we did a internal poll last year, and we do keep track of everybody as well. That's a big part of our system of continued support, building that community, which is absolutely key. But we did an internal polling, and had a few different metrics, and everybody that answered the poll 100% said that their life had at least somewhat improved since the ayahuasca retreat, that it was beneficial from there. No matter what, life has its ups and downs, but they all felt like they had a better grasp on their life and understanding it, and at least where their true path was, whether they always followed that or not. So that was very endearing for us and pushing us to continue this work. But yeah, I mean, just on an anecdotal level, just still interacting with people, of just seeing complete life transformation, complete, you know, people who were had suicidal ideation, never going back to that ground again.
Peace and social justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. Peace and social justice is also made possible by Dr. Ken Logan, family practitioner. Ken believes in the importance of community radio and encourages other members of the medical community to join the KZFR underwriting family. That's Dr. Ken Logan, family practitioner. I'm speaking with Jesse Gould, the founder and president of Heroic Hearts Project. And I think really, literally, you are doing heroic work. Jesse, I'm curious, you are a nonprofit, so do the veterans who you accept, are they funded, or how's the funding work? And, you know, what's the cost for something like this? If there are veterans listening who are interested and want to get on the wait list or something, what's the financial situation? How does that work?
Yeah, so that's part of what we, in addition to our program, we provide financial grants. Unfortunately, those that are suffering from trauma also tend to be financially unstable, which is obviously correlated. And so that's why we're here as a nonprofit to ease the passage of veterans to these retreats. Each veteran costs on average about $4,000. And obviously, for a lot of us, that's very cost prohibitive, even if we did think it was save our lives. You know, a lot of people, even if they knew that, it would be so hard to come up with $4,000. So we tend to work on a sliding scale on a veteran to veteran basis. We like to have them have some sort of investment in their healing. But, you know, if somebody, we're not going to make them, you know, miss rent for the sake of going on this. So it's really on a personal scale of those that can afford more and those maybe that can cover their costs. And we encourage them to do so because then that helps other veterans down the line. For those that are very down and out, then, you know, that's where we step in and are happy to help. So it's really on the individual basis. But the vast majority of those that we served, we provided some sort of financial support. And so that's really the point of the nonprofit and where, you know, hopefully your listeners and other people's donations and support comes in because it goes directly. You know, this is one of the most ways of, if you want to support vets, where your money goes exactly to the cause of supporting vets with very low overhead. Otherwise, we're still an all volunteer organization. And so you can be pretty assured that the money is going there. In addition to that, we also sponsor some other programs like getting veterans that have gone through our program to become integration coaches themselves. So going through a pretty comprehensive course, and then they come back and then they facilitate other veterans. So things like that of just, again, community building and this notion of paying it forward. And a lot of people who go through this program, because of the healing that they find, really want to give back to other veterans, which is a very beautiful thing.
Jesse Gould, I notice, of course, that you don't have centers in the States, I'm sure, because of the drug laws, because of legal issues. But I mean, you're the expert here. It seems to me that things are definitely changing culturally in the United States. I noticed that in California, there was a Assembly Bill SB 519, which I think recently got shelved, but that was a put forth, I think it was Senator Scott Weiner, who wants to decriminalize psychedelics. Are you noticing a shift in perceptions away from the stigmatizing of psychedelics? You know, do you thinking in the future, rather than having to, send people overseas, perhaps we can have centers in the United States for veterans?
Absolutely. You're seeing a huge tidal shift. We're, on the inner circles, it's called definitely the Renaissance of mental health, the psychedelic Renaissance. For that very reason, especially in the past couple of years, it's just expanded pretty rapidly, and that's not only in the research side, where more and more, so many researchers, professionals are just getting excited and doing new proposals with major institutions like Johns Hopkins University and Harvard and NYU and Stanford. But then also on the local level. So there's been a lot of decriminalization movements, notably Oakland in California, Washington, D.C., a few places in Michigan and in Massachusetts. One of the biggest ones recently was in Oregon, Measure 109, which passed last November. And in 2 years or a year and a half now, that will allow a person to actually go to a clinic and get psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy, as well as the option to do it in a more communal setting. So that will be, it's a pretty landmark bill that passed. Texas recently passed a legislation that will enforce a certain amount of funds going specifically to psychedelic research, which is another major one. The one you mentioned, SB 519, and Heroic Hearts has been active in all of these and pushing for all of these. And Measure 109, another one, we were a co-sponsor of that bill with Senator Weiner. It got delayed, but it still made a lot of traction. It made it further than any similar bill has ever. And the reason for the delay is just because We want to make sure you can pause it at certain spots in the process, because if it goes through, the last step is the assembly and then the governor's signature. If we push it through the assembly, we just weren't 100% sure that we would get the votes. And if that's the case, if we didn't, then it would go right back to ground zero. So now it just gives us some more time to start talking with people, bringing the research, bringing the facts, education. And so hopefully by next year, we'll be able to push the last couple of steps. And then that will allow decriminalization, but also communal access. So it's happening. Decrim, it's still, even if it's decriminalized, it's still hard. It's still impossible. You're still not allowed to build, like, necessarily clinics or centers. But it's a step in the right motion, the right direction. It's really an education sort of issue. What we found, especially with all the politicians we talked to, when you present the facts and you show them how effective these are versus other treatments, the vast majority, especially reasonable people, will see the writing on the wall of, like, this is the future. It's very hard to ignore unless somebody's very entrenched in their anti sort of drug opinion, which is the case a lot as well. But those that are, like I said, reasonable and open to the what the facts are actually presenting, then it's starting to be there. And so right now it's really that education going from, you know, we all have that stigma. If I say psychedelics, we all think the same thing, 1970s, hippies, you know, society going down in some sort of way because people are on drugs or what have you. So we're changing that, what's actually being shown and realistic points of view. And the veteran story is very powerful to that because it's one of those things that can bring this issue agreement on both sides of the aisle, which is what we're seeing, which is very heartening in how polarized the country has been, that hopefully we can come together at least for the sake of, you know, supporting veterans that are seeking effective mental health. And then that will necessarily expand to everybody that has mental health issues, which is a huge issue across the population. But veterans are really stepping up and becoming leaders of this movement, and it's been very effective. So in the future, I mean, you're already seeing groundwork for it with ketamine clinics. Again, not a traditional psychedelic, but can operate in very similar ways. And so there's clinics of that where people can get, again, more effective therapy. As research advances and these substances become more legal or pass FDA trials, then those clinics and other groups will sort of expand to where it'll just increase access and different options for this, which, you know, at the end of the day, if more people can get help in different manners, and that's, in my opinion, a great thing.
Well, Jesse Gold, if for our listeners who either A, want to contribute to your nonprofit, or for those listeners who are veterans who are interested in perhaps applying for a spot here to have this kind of therapy, where can they reach you? How can they contact you? What should they do?
Whoever is interested in learning more, please reach out. We always like to hear from you, whether a veteran or not. Our website is heroicheartsproject.org, heroicheartsproject.org. We're on all social media, Instagram being the biggest one. Just look up Heroic Hearts Project. It'll be pretty easy to find. So for veterans that are interested in learning more and possibly filling out an application, again, they can go to that website, veterans sign up, and then there's outline details, an application process. When they fill it out, they go on sort of the wait list right now, and then when we have the ability to fund retreats, we'll reach out to them. We have an ambassador program, so veteran or civilian or professional who just wants to support and wants to be active in this movement, they can fill out their own application, and we kind of present them sort of this weekly update of, or a monthly update, excuse me, of what's going on. And then we have volunteer positions within our organization of where they can help out, especially depending on expertise. You know, donations, like I said, it's one of the directest way you can help support veterans, help support the troops. We try to keep it as pure as possible, donations coming in, going directly to the intended cause. And so that's on our website too. Just go there and there's an easy donate tab. And, you know, like I said, it costs about $4,000 per veteran. So whatever support people can do to help that is greatly appreciated. As a 501c3, all tax, all donations are tax deductible. So yeah, whatever ways you can support, you can sponsor veterans, you can sponsor full retreats. We have executive retreats for those that have more financial ability where they can actually go and sponsor a retreat, go there with veterans and experience it together. So there's a lot of different options. It's just reaching out and helping us push this mission forward.
We've been speaking with Jesse Gould, who is the founder and president of the Heroic Hearts Project, and he has spearheaded the research and acceptance of ayahuasca therapy programs for military veterans. His mission is to help military veterans struggling with mental trauma and spread awareness of the benefits that ayahuasca therapies offer as an alternative treatment to pharmaceuticals. Jesse Gould, thank you so much for taking the time to share your experiences with the listeners here on the Peace and Social Justice Program. And good luck to you. You're doing great, heroic work. Thanks for your work, Jesse.
Thank you so much for having me, Robert. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and I really appreciate the platform. And I look forward to getting feedback from your audience and talking with them individually.
In this segment of the Peace and Social Justice Program, I'd like to talk about a local hero, if you will, who recently passed away. I think our community is definitely impoverished now that she has gone. Jana Burgess Henry, who was a member of Chico Friends on the Street for a number of years. As a kind of memorial to discuss the role that Jana played in her activism and who she was, I have in the studio with me Mr. Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street. Patrick, welcome to the Peace and Social Justice Program.
Good to be here again, Robert. Thank you.
So, Patrick, can you give us a little background? I don't know who Jana was to you there are people listening who have no idea who Jana was or what she did for the community, the kind of activism she was involved in. Give us a little background, who we're talking about.
Probably one way to approach it is to just go back and remember when I first met Jana. It was about 4 years ago, and I reluctantly got on Facebook to try to do activism through social media, which is an interesting subject in itself. But that's how I crossed paths with Jana initially. We saw that there was some connection in terms of our comments on Facebook, and this is all in the arena that swirls around people who live on our streets and what kinds of conditions they experience, what responses our community has produced. And generally speaking, the whole question of what their human rights are on the streets. And so there was some alignment, some sense of, you know, common purpose between me and Jana that we noticed. And so we met, and we had about a 3-hour conversation when we first met. And that conversation was important because we found that there was a lot of common ground and similar ways of thinking. And previous to that, Jana had worked with a group called Chico Community Watch, which was doing cleanups in the plaza. And we'll get into Jana's background a little bit here in a minute, but she has a background in botany and horticulture and biology. And so I think the natural world has always been important to her. And I think being part of Chico Community Watch and doing cleanup in the greenways of Chico is an appealing thing to do on sort of an environmental level. As she did that work, she found that there were other people involved in that work, and there were some real differences of opinion about how the groups who do cleanup should be responding to people who are living in those spaces. And Jana is a person who has a life experience that's led her to see those people who are living in our public spaces very differently than people who are antagonistic to people in our public spaces and their interests. So Jana found her a sort of polarity there between her and some of the opinions of people that were doing that cleanup work. And that makes sense, you know, because Jana's principles are very much aligned with people's human rights, and her whole life experience has led her to that. So, or had led her to that. So, I think when we explored what Chico Friends on the Street's about, what our mission's about, and how we see the rights of people in the public space, that was much closer to her heart. And in fact, there was a lot of alignment. And I mean, one of the most devastating things about losing Jana is that it's very rare to find people who identify heavily with human rights principles for the visibly poor. It's just exceptional. And her intelligence and life experience and heart were all just highly unusual. So it's a big loss. But we can go through more of the details of all that.
Well, if you would, Patrick Newman, just for a moment, could you just maybe say something about the principles to which you refer that you and Jana Burgess Henry were simpatico on? What are the kind of things you have in mind?
So the central notions there, or mission, is that Chico Friends on the Street has sort of focused on a pretty narrow niche of what's going on with poverty in America. And that's, okay, we stipulate out of the box that there's not enough housing available for people, that some people lose in a competition for housing, and that's a failure in itself. That's a human rights violation right on its face. But then once that human rights violation, denial of housing, which is right there in the UN Charter of Human Rights, which the U.S. never signed, once you stipulate that this is happening and there's a crisis and you have hundreds of thousands of people spilling onto your streets, who's paying attention to what kind of rights they have as they exist in the public spaces? So these are questions of whether they have 24-hour toilet access. Do they have the right to rest? Meaning, do they have places where they can sleep safely without being harassed or, you know, moved along by the police constantly? Do they have the things that they need so that they're not experiencing deprivation on the streets? Can they stay warm? Do they have a sleeping bag? Do they have a tarp? Do they have hats and gloves and those kinds of things? How does the community see them in that space? Are they demonized? Are they in any way welcome in our public spaces? So to address all that, you know, the focus of Chico Friends on the Street has been trying to get 24-hour toilet access, trying to challenge the city on our unconstitutional laws that make right to rest or sitting in public spaces illegal, whether or not, you know, we have some place where there's a no barrier kind of access to the things people need. So that was all, I mean, Sunday after Sunday in the plaza, and Jana was there year after year. A few of the things we were doing, I mean, because there's this interest in the welfare and the rights of the people on the streets, meeting them in a public space is a way of saying you are affirmed in your right to be here. You're affirmed in your very existence. And not only that, but we're going to try to produce as much material as we can to fill, you know, to close that gap on deprivation. So if people need tarps and they need sleeping bags and they need, you know, just warm winter clothing and they need food and they need toiletries, then the idea is there is to try to, you know, address that deprivation. So all of that stuff made sense to Jana immediately because her values and life experience all aligned with that. And so it's something that I think she understood in as much depth as I do. And so that was, you know, an immediate connection. And so her participation on Sundays, I mean, she was more focused on materials like hats and gloves and all those kinds of things, sleeping bags, tarps, and on food, but less on food, but more on those kinds of materials that she, you know, she purchased and personally brought and stood in solidarity with people in the streets and made those things available to people year after year and spent a lot of her own money on it too. Exceptional kind of participation.
I'm speaking today with Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, Patrick and I are kind of, in a sense, memorializing a member of Chico Friends on the Street, a devoted and heroic activist who recently passed away, Janet Burgess Henry. I should also let listeners know that earlier this year, Jana, along with Patrick and Cicery Sherry, three members of Chico Friends on the Street, appeared on the Peace and Social Justice program, and I will include a link to that interview with Jana on the website with our broadcast today here on KZFR. So these values that you sort of immediately found, you know, you hit it off with Jana. If you could just tell us a little bit about who Jana was, who she was to you, and her role in not only in CFOTS but in the community. You did allude earlier to her affinity and love for the natural environment and her dedication to cleaning up and contributing in that sense. But tell us a little bit more about who Jana Burgess Henry was.
Yeah, Jana grew up near where I grew up in the Santa Clara Valley, and she took off after high school and spent a couple of years living basically a homeless life, living out of a van. She found her way eventually to getting a degree. Well, she was first at Chico State. She studied botany and then biology and then chemistry, and excelled at Chico State. Her son Jesse and her daughter Leah just told me that when she graduated, she had every single like medal possible like around her neck when she was graduating because of all the honors that she got there. And she really impressed her mentors. And from there, she went on to UC Santa Barbara and then spent some years in the pharmaceutical industry before she came back to Chico State as a teacher. So, and she was there for 17 years. But intermixed in that, and these are the things that I think probably, you know, added to her maybe innate sense of justice and connection with poor people. Well, there was that time she spent on the road really knowing what it's like to be homeless. And then I think there was periods in there where she really struggled with poverty. And she worked in, well, for she lived in Southern Oregon for about 5 or 6 years without running water or electricity, and raised a family that way. So there is a kind of like direct experience of what it's like to have to struggle with the elements and all that kind of stuff. When she worked for a pharmaceutical company in San Francisco, she lived near parts of the Mission District that were quite impoverished. And we've talked about that in the past, like her experiences of poverty on the streets there. So even on the Chico State campus, she was a person who pushed for more tolerance and understanding of the homeless population that lived near the science building where she worked, and really pushed to kind of challenge her colleagues on the question of, you know, whether the people who were sort of living in that environment right there next to Children's Park were actually threatening or dangerous or undesirable and all those kinds of things that people tend to think. Jana's approach was to get to know them and to have direct experiences of who they were and make connections with them. So there's sort of a whole like life experience that, you know, led up to the connection to Chico Friends on the Street. But my experience of Jana in terms of, you know, problem solving and thinking things through, she's just a really great critical thinker and understood things intuitively and quickly. And so there's a swirl of politics in Chico and around these issues. And Jana was a person who, she just had this disciplined and kind of intelligence that made it really helpful in sorting issues out, you know, talking about things. So there's quite a mix of elements there, but all in you know, kind of one magnificent person.
That's the voice of Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a human rights activist organization. And we are in discussion about the passing of a member of Chico Friends on the Street, Jana Burgess Henry, who passed away last week. You mentioned this aspect of her history that her experience with, as you mentioned, she herself experienced homelessness, and she herself lived kind of, quote, off the grid for a number of years. And I'm wondering if you might say something about that kind of experience and its relationship to empathy for suffering, as well as being dynamic as an activist. And I'm not implying that in order to have a certain kind of empathy for suffering or to be a dynamic activist, it's necessary or it's required that you have had these kinds of experiences. But I'm wondering, Patrick Newman, if you could say something about specifically, you know, if you will, in particular to Jana, or more generally, this experience and how that may cultivate a certain kind of empathy, sympathy, awareness to suffering, and kind of dynamism when it comes to being an activist.
The way I look at that, I think when I reflect on that, I see Jana as the kind of person who had life experience that gave her a kind of courage, and how much of that, you know, is learned or innate or whatever, but a kind of courage that allowed her to be comfortable with people who are seen by a lot of people in society as being unapproachable. Like there's something about them that just others them in a way because of their visible poverty and their struggle, their obvious suffering, that creates a sort of barrier because of who they are. I never sensed that with Jana at all. It's like what I was saying about her connecting with people near the campus throughout the time she was teaching there. Well, that same sort of familiarity and comfort with people was there on the plaza. It's like there was nothing that intimidated Jana. She was a tough person. There was nothing there that, you know, was threatening. So there's this ability to move into this, you know, into this environment and be with these people in a very direct way. And that, I think that kind of, I really believe that kind of intimacy is really useful in getting close enough to the suffering of people so that it starts to really remake our thinking. And this would be true of many other arenas where there's suffering in the world. Without getting close enough to it, it's easy to get lost in abstractions. And getting closer to it makes it tangible, and I think it challenges us in a different way. So that's something that I think, you know, was, you know, fundamental to who Jana was, because when she looks at some issue, you know, like anything that's happened in the last few years, and I should mention that in the last year, especially, we've had legal challenges that Jana was involved with. She was involved with legal services, and she wrote a declaration for the, you know, that was part of the process that led to the injunction that's in place right now, and also worked with the ACLU on creating an amicus brief for that same case. These are like technical things, but what are you grounded in when you approach these technical things? And if you're grounded in that deep experience of people, you know, I would argue that is powerful in informing how you approach that. So when you're asked to do a declaration on what you've seen in the sweeps, that declaration's informed by a kind of deep knowledge of what's going on with the people that are there. Another thing, I mean, is, you know, in that whole process of having the sweeps that were done here in Chico, and which ultimately led to the injunction and the involvement of the ACLU, we did a 12-day, well, we were there, Jana and I were there the day they swept Bidwell Park the first time. Not long after they were about to sweep the triangle, and we did 12 days together. The commitment was 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock every day. So 12 days, 4 hours a day, standing on the corner, trying to, you know, collect a sort of critical mass of opposition to this triangle sweep, which was going to be the next one.
And just to clarify for the listeners, so this was attempts by the city, which turned out to be sadly successful attempts, to basically rid these particular areas of folks who were living there, of homeless folks who were living there. And CFOTS, Chico Friends on the Street, held it sounds kind of almost like holding vigil in a certain way in solidarity with the folks who are there. And you spent hours for 12 days. Jana was one of the few people who was there. She was there pretty much as a diehard.
Yeah, Jana was there day after day after day for those 12 days, every single day. So, yeah, and it's an exceptional kind of participation because, or commitment or investment, I guess, because out of a city of 100,000 people, you know, you get 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, and maybe on a good day you get 12, but there just aren't that many people. And so, what we're kind of getting at here, I think a little bit, is that, yeah, there's two things going on here. There's this heart thing and empathy and a sense of connection to the experience. And there's a reason thing going on here too, that has to do with Jana's ability to really think about things in depth and look at them in that way. So the question of like, okay, what happens when, you know, you bring, cause what we had was in the middle of winter, the city changed its policy on shelter in place and decided to start evicting people from these public spaces. This was in January, almost a year. Well, it'll be a year ago soon. That would be seen in different ways, depending on what your life experience was. And Jana was, I think she had a lot of life experiences that led her to a deeper understanding of why someone might need to shelter in the public space. And then she brought, I think, values of justice to that too.
I'm speaking with Patrick Newman, the founder of Chico Friends on the Street, a human rights and homeless advocacy organization here in Chico. And we are discussing the passing of a member of Chico Friends on the Street, but also a dear friend, Jana Burgess Henry, who passed away last week. She was quite an activist and quite dedicated a lot of her time and energy to assisting those least fortunate, most demonized in the city of Chico currently, which, of course, is the unhoused. Patrick, this is an interesting concept, this idea of the distinction between having intellectual understanding of a given situation, say the plight of homelessness, and then having this emotional connection, which, in Jana's case, came from this experience she had. And it seems to me that Jana sort of had both. She had both houses covered. She had the intellectual deep understanding that's rare, but she brought heart and soul and empathy to the situation. I think it's interesting that two citizens of Chico can stand before folks living in the plaza having the very same experience, you know, having the very same data, if you will, come in and have two radically different intellectual and emotional experiences. On the one hand, you have people who say these people are vermin and get rid of them and the city's dirty and we need to clean them up. And the emotional response is one of disgust or revulsion or rejection. And then you have someone else, and I think is clearly exemplified by Jana, who not only did she understand the sort of structural, deep political, structural, and social, socioeconomic reasons that produce things like poverty, but also she had a deep, like I said, she had this deep empathy and came from this place of her having a soul and understanding. I'm wondering if you have any more thoughts. It's such a fascinating distinction. I'm just thinking about the current state of the city and this demonization of the homeless. And, you know, neither you nor I, Patrick, is a psychologist or a sociologist, but I do think that we are entitled to, you know, ruminate about the difference in engagement with people in the community. Jana being an exemplar of what I would consider someone with compassion and intelligence and kindness and care versus what I see as the other side, which is often filled with hate and revulsion. I don't know. Can you speak to some of that?
Well, I think one way to look at that is just to look at what happened today and yesterday with, you know, erecting a fence around the downtown plaza again. This will be the third time in the last year where they've fenced off the plaza, which just, you know, for people's general understanding, that's a resource for people on the streets. That's how I look at it. If you have no home, the places, public places, especially places like that where you can meet other people and have access to toilets and you're sort of in the central part of the city, that becomes your living room, your bedroom, your kitchen, your bathroom. And when, you know, you put a fence around that in order to install, at great expense, a skating rink in the middle of, well, what's been a pretty violent storm over the last few days, which makes it even more painful to watch. You fence people off from the only functional downtown toilets, at least in the core of the city there. I mean, after years of fighting for toilets, they've removed at least two of the ones that we finally got. We're just talking portables here. And it's a deliberate, you know, attempt to deprive people and make the public space unusable. It's like, say, well, it's still there, but wow, it's got a fence around it. There's no toilets, et cetera. Okay. So, and parenthetically, Comanche Creek just got flooded. So, people who were camping there lost that space. But here's where Jana comes in. You know, now it's like, there's a person who fully understands the impact of that. And you can have that discussion with somebody like Jana. And there's other people in Chico who get it too. But it's very, very rare. It's like most people, when you say, hey, I don't think it's right or reasonable to fence off the plaza for an ice skating rink, which is really a kind of recreational extravagance for people who have money, and deprive the people who are the most, you know, the most suffering, most desperate people of the use of that space because you don't like the blight and you want to drive them away. These are things that Jana would understand at every level. And the thing that I will desperately miss is being able to get on the phone with someone like Jana and say, hey, let's kick that around and have, you know, another person who gets that, so that when I go to the city council meeting or something and oppose the creation of this ice rink on these grounds, I know that I'm not the only person in the city who feels that way. And so when you talk about like people driving by and seeing very different things, that's really, I mean, Jana is a great example of someone who saw it from my perspective clearly. Like, this is, I understand what these people are experiencing. I understand why this is wrong. And it doesn't matter if 99.9% of people think it's just fine to kick the homeless out of that space and put an ice skating rink in. It's still wrong. It's still the wrong thing to do. It's not compassionate and it's not fair. And frankly, I think it's a violation of the injunction too, because that is a park and there were people camping there. And they've been driven out of that space. So I don't know the legal ins and outs of that, but trying to answer the question from the point of view of like, okay, how do two people see something like this most recent, you know, development through different lenses, and the way someone like Jana would see it, how I know already how she would have seen it. So and actually we may have talked about that in the last month or so when this, yeah, I think we did, when this was all, you know, being pushed through the council. So that's just a way to try to, I don't know, conceptualize that difference. Someone like Jana would get it. Someone like Jana knows what that means. And again, some of this comes from, well, if you've spent Sunday after Sunday after Sunday standing in the plaza, and it becomes really painful to do that. At least that's my own experience of it. To watch, like Sunday we were out there not for very long. It was pouring rain. We brought some stuff to people, and you're just watching people that are broken down and really suffering. And that experience is, it's like a discipline. I wish that was better understood, because I think just being with people on their turf, experiencing even for an hour or two or three a week what they're experiencing, is informative. And I think Jana was willing to be more informed over time, more and more and more informed, like it's a path. that she was on, and that's a direction. It's like a moral direction. So, yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the term moral directions. Yeah, Jana, to confront the suffering in that way and to respond with care and compassion, it speaks to a kind of moral courage that seems rare that someone like Jana possessed, because it's certainly easier to look away, or certainly easier to demonize, to deny, but it takes a kind of moral courage, it's a kind of moral compass to keep your eyes open in to face that kind of suffering and to engage it rather than to shy away from it.
I think there's one other way to expand this a little bit too, and that is to look at how Jana looked at issues outside of this arena, because she was a lifelong animal rights activist or a deep thinker on the subject, a lifelong vegetarian. Her understanding, I mean, she had a background in horticulture. She was a UC Davis master gardener. She had a connection to the natural world, and so her environmental ethic was really strong. I think of these three arenas all the time: human deprivation, animal suffering, and environmental suffering, as being like the three areas of suffering in the world that we can either look at more deeply or turn away from. And so it's not surprising that her whole approach to, you know, lifestyle was one where she really cultivated a kind of sensitivity to her impact on the world and the suffering that she created. And so those kinds of issues really all overlap and intertwine. And so that's another dimension to this.
Well, Patrick Newman, as we wrap up here, we head into the end of this segment. Any final thoughts, reflections that you have about Jana Burgess Henry that you want to share with our listeners?
All I can say is my heart goes out to Jesse and her son Jesse and her daughter Leah and her daughter-in-law Melody, who are all fine people and have been involved on the streets with us also. I will miss Jana a lot.
She will be missed. The town of Chico is definitely a darker place now that Jana Burgess Henry has passed. Patrick, if there are listeners who are interested in contacting you, contributing to Chico Friends on the Street, participating with activities with Chico Friends on the Street, interested in learning more about Jana and her kind of activism, how can people reach you? How can we get a hold of you?
I think the best way, I mean, our sort of core discipline has been to show up in the public space every Sunday at 12 o'clock. We're now going to be across the street in front of the city hall because the plaza has been closed. And also, there's a new program started by Cicely Sherry. It's Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9 o'clock, and that's a coffee hour. Those are like core activities that I think are a great place to step into this arena and you know, begin to make that connection. I can be contacted at chicofriendsonthestreet@gmail.com. Obviously, what we do requires funds, and this is the time of year when winter's coming. This would be my sixth winter on the plaza. People on the streets at this time of year usually have nothing, because no one can haul stuff around all summer long. So they don't have hats, they don't have gloves, they don't have sleeping bags, they don't have tarps, they don't have warm coats, because there's nowhere to store any of these things. So I've found that year after year after year, when this kind of weather comes, which we've already, you know, we're already seeing in October, there's a need to re-up everyone on all that stuff, basic stuff. There's always a need for food. So, it would be wonderful if more people participated on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, any way that they feel like they can. Financial support's helpful if anybody wants to contact us on that, or just to have the conversation, because I, from the very beginning of my involvement, 6 or 7 years ago, or 8 years ago, I guess it was, to me, it's always been about the narrative. It's always been like, what do we do to change the way we think and move our thinking over toward humanizing and seeing that people on the streets have rights and that we have a responsibility to look at what those rights are. So that's a conversation that I really believe in, although, you know, it's at times it seems futile, but I still believe that the culture can change from one of violence against the poor to one that at very least looks at people in the public spaces as being valid, worthy human beings that, you know, don't have to be our enemies, but can be our friends. So,
well, Patrick Newman, thank you for your time, for sharing your experiences, your thoughts, and your reflections about Janet Burgess Henry. Godspeed, Janet Burgess Henry.
Thank you so much for having me on, Robert.
Thanks, Patrick. Thank you for listening to the program, and we'll be back in a week.
Thank you, Robert, for that very, very important peace and social justice program. It is a winter is a very, very tough time out on the street for these folks, so please show some compassion. My name's Ray. It's time for Playing Dead, Music the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon, and you are listening to 90.1 KZFR, listener-supported community radio for the universe. Coming out of Chico, California, streaming live at kzfr.org, also on your smart device through our free app. So you can listen to KZFR everywhere you get a signal. Alrighty, it is Fall Pledge Drive, as everybody knows. kzfr.org is the place to go. We've got a special Pledge Drive show, got a lot of great music, and all rockin' stuff, all killer, no filler, as the Rastaman says. If you want to give us a call, it's 601-340-KZFR, 601-340-KZFR. Really, the place to go is KZFR.org, and you can check out all the cool thank you gifts. We've got some new stuff. Make your payment arrangements. It's easy. It's so much easier than on the staff here, and, you know, the world is reduced, so we're doing more with